Hi. Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys for Legal Geeks. It is fantastic to be back at WonderCon in person.
Yay!
Thank you for joining us for The Law of Peacemaker. Our panel tonight, each of them say something about themselves. First up is Gabby Martin.
Hi, I'm Gabby Martin. I work for the Office of the State Treasurer in the state of Connecticut. Practicing attorney, love. Peacemaker.
I want to ask, do you want to taste it? Do you really want to taste it?
Yes.
I'm Kathy Simon. I'm a deputy city attorney for the city of San Diego.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stephen Tallfield. I'm a lecturer and a director of the writing program at UC Hastings College of the Law.
Woo-hoo. I'm a practicing attorney in San Ramon, California, at Green and Piper Salinger in Raleigh. And this is a fun way to help people understand what is the practice of law. And when you watch a TV show, you wonder, who's going to pay for that? Is that illegal? Would they be in trouble? And the answer is yes. Yes, they would be in trouble. So, first up.
They're a little muffled, so.
Muffled. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, first time presenting with a mask on. So, first up, Kathy, could I have a pet eagle if I wanted one?
So there's a couple of laws we need to take a look at when we ask whether or not you can have an eagle as a pet. The first one is the Endangered Species Act, which was passed in 1973. For our purposes, what's relevant here is that it is unlawful for any person to possess, sell, deliver, carry, transport, or ship any such endangered species. So then we've got to figure out, well, are bald eagles endangered or threatened? And the Endangered Species Act protects only endangered and threatened species. And there's five criteria that is analyzed to determine whether or not they are endangered or threatened. And actually, bald eagles is an example of a success story of the Endangered Species Act, because they actually were, their population numbers increased significantly enough that they were removed from the list in 2007. But our inquiry does not end there. We have two other federal laws that apply to bald eagles, and we have the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. It's actually much older than the Endangered Species Act, and that was a treaty established with several countries that prohibits the taking, including capturing, killing, trading, and transport of protected migratory bird species, and bald eagles are among the protected animals under that statute. There's also the Bald Eagle Protection Act, which was passed in 1940 because at that time bald eagles were threatened with extinction. And that law prohibits the taking, possessing, selling, purchasing, bartering, offering to sell, purchase, or barter, transport, in any time or manner, any bald eagle, and it also includes golden eagles as well. So you cannot have a pet bald eagle.
So Gabby, let's talk about the liability for a butterfly taking over a human body.
Yeah, so obviously, there's no safe way for butterflies to be removed. There's no kind of surgery that can safely remove a butterfly from the host human body. So the bodies end up dead. But until that point, they are being moved. So the butterflies are definitely guilty of kidnapping. So under the Model Penal Code, kidnapping occurs when any person is unlawfully or non-consensually escorted, which means to be taken, and held for one of the following purposes. Obviously, a ransom, which is obviously kind of what we're all familiar with, to facilitate the commission of any flight or felony thereafter, to inflict bodily injury on or terrorize the victim, to interfere with the performance of any governmental or political function. And clearly the butterflies are guilty of these last three. So you're hitting at least three elements of kidnapping. So, pick your poison.
Yeah, not if the host is outright dead already. So let's talk about political influence. And Stephen, what happens if a butterfly takes over a U.S. senator?
Yeah, I mean, our democracy really recoils from the idea of having other foreign interests meddling in our political affairs, and we find out at the sort of at the end of the series, of course, the butterflies are here to make to influence policy decisions to help us avoid a climate disaster. However, federal law does require that when you're an agent who's working on behalf of a foreign interest, or lobbying, for example, you have to register under the Federal or Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938, which was passed right before World War II because of all the Nazi propaganda that was flooding into the United States. So it's not unlawful to lobby on behalf of a foreign government. You just have to do it transparently. And that's what was going on in Paul Manafort's trial in 2018, because he had not registered as a foreign agent, even though he was influencing policy on the behalf of foreign actors. The other way that the federal government tries to prevent this is through campaign finance laws. You're not allowed to pour money from a foreign government into a political campaign or any sort of election process. That's unlawful. And then lastly, it's not a statute yet, but Senator Klobuchar has introduced the Election Security Act, which does a bunch of things to secure elections, but one of the things it does requires, it requires the manufacturer of all voting machines that are used in the U.S. in the U.S. to avoid foreign companies and governments from penetrating U.S. elections. So I'm sure the butterflies did not register with the Attorney General before taking over, so I'm sure they violated at least the FARA, of course.
Well, but speaking of senators, Gabby, who killed Senator Gall first?
Well, to go back to what we were saying earlier, it's kind of assumed that the butterflies, by entering a host body, are guilty of murder from the time they enter the body, because there's no safe way of being removed, right? So they're guilty of kidnapping and also of murder. So actually 18 U.S. Code 351 actually covers kidnapping and killing a U.S. senator, other members of the executive branch, elected officials. And the punishment is either life in prison or the death penalty.
So hypothetically, if you were encouraging someone to go hang a sitting vice president, it's attempted murder under this section. At least a resourceful U.S. attorney could try to argue that.
Then it could indeed, Josh.
That would be fun if that happened.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, so let's talk about false impersonation with butterflies. And Kathy, can you help us out here?
So, under Washington state law, a person is guilty of criminal impersonation if the person assumes a false identity and doesn't act as the assumed character with the intent to defraud another or for another unlawful purpose. So here we have the butterflies that basically take over a ton of people in the town, and a lot of them are basically the entire police force at one point. So you have all of these butterflies that are impersonating police officers, with the intent, and they're acting and holding press conferences and whatnot as these law enforcement officers, with the intent to basically make people believe that they are acting. And then the other thing I would say too is there's also an unlawful purpose in that they're basically trying to stage a coup, taking over the entire United States and the world, right? So they meet both prongs there. They're intending to defraud, and also they've got an unlawful purpose there. So they would definitely be guilty of false impersonation.
So trying to overthrow the government is a crime.
Yeah.
So
pretty clearly.
Sorry, Charlie. Stephen, excuse me, Gabby, can you say what happens if you try to kill a gorilla?
So this is a classic case of defense of others, right? So it's codified in those state laws, and particularly, as we know, Peacemaker takes place in Washington state. So Washington Code 9A16020 codifies the defense of others. And so that you can use force upon another person legally whenever the party about to be injured is, you're using the use of force to prevent injury to another person.
And this is also kind of interesting because DC has a lot of smart gorillas. Marvel doesn't do that, it's a DC thing. And it's just kind of fascinating. It is fascinating to see. So on that, let's talk about having a really horrible sense of family entertainment. You want to have your children engage in a bare knuckles boxing match to entertain some racists. And Kathy, could you talk about, you know, why this is a bad parenting choice and the legal issues?
So I wanted to look at this and analyze it from two different viewpoints. First, whether there's a liability for the children that are involved. And most states have statutes that basically say that children are not capable of forming what we call mens rea in the law, which is basically criminal intent. You have to have the intent to commit a crime in order to actually be guilty for many crimes. And children are generally incapable of forming that mens rea. And in Washington State specifically, children under 8 are incapable of committing a crime because they aren't considered to have the intellectual capacity to form that criminal intent. But children between 8 and 12 are presumed to be incapable of committing a crime. But it's a presumption, it's a rebuttable presumption. You can present evidence that says, no, they were capable, or they were intellectually capable of forming that, knowing that they did was wrong, knowing that it was a crime. So it's rebuttable. You could charge a child with a crime if you can show that that they were capable of forming the criminal intent. Here the question is how old is Chris when he engages in that? Is he between the ages of 8 and 12? A little unclear from the TV series, but if he's over 12, then definitely he could be charged. So the other way that I wanted to look at this was, what's the liability of the of Augie, the parent, for forcing his children to into this boxing match? And we're talking about here contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And so in Washington state, I could not find a state statute that talked about contributing to the delinquency of a minor. It was all governed by local ordinances. And most of them generally say that it's unlawful to knowingly encourage or cause a child under 18 to violate any laws of the U.S., the state, or the local jurisdiction. And then additionally, one other thing is this would apply not just to Augie, but also all of his racist friends who were in attendance, watching this. You have a duty to anyone who witnesses crimes against a child or, abuses and things like that, you have a duty to report that to the authorities. And it does include the assault of a child that appears reasonably likely to cause substantial body harm to the child. So basically, almost everyone involved, except the children, depending on their ages and whether or not they were able to form criminal intent, would be liable for participating in this boxing match.
So, Gabby, let's talk about the Gab of the Year for 1989. what's the parent liability for having a minor murder someone?
Well, to go to the question, is obviously this crime would be child abuse, and is Augie guilty of child abuse? I think should be a resounding
yes.
Thank you. To all the non-lawyers, you are correct. Abuse and neglect. I mean, clearly, from a common sense perspective, he's guilty of child abuse, but legally as well. Abuse or neglect in Washington state means injury of a child by any person under circumstances which cause harm to the child's health, welfare, and safety, or the negligent treatment or maltreatment of a child by a person responsible for or providing care to the child. Clearly, Augie's providing care. He's the only parent in this situation, parent guardian figure, and I think he caused harm by having young Chris murder an innocent prisoner, well, maybe not innocent, but clearly a prisoner of some kind, and all the other wonderful Dad of the Year activities clearly caused harm to Chris's health, welfare, safety, and were considered negligent treatment.
Yeah, father-son bonding should not include shanking someone.
Yeah.
So, Let's talk about the thing that I hear the most, hearing a child say, "Are you my real dad?" And let's get into what are the, Chris's, the peacemaker's parental rights and obligations, and finding out, hey, you're a dad.
So he would have to, family court in Washington State would have to determine first that he is the father, Jerry Springer. So once there is actually a kind of order that paternity is found by the court can order him to pay child support, which would depend on the custody arrangement. I don't think he's taking custody of Skinny Arms anytime soon. I don't think the court would award him any custody anytime soon. And would also determine on his income, the minimum amount for, there are child support guidelines, and the minimum amount is about $50 in Washington State. And so obviously the non-custodial parent, peacemaker in this case, if he is determined to be the father, would pay child support. And in addition to the basic child support, you also have to, that's the kind of monthly payment that a father or other non-custodial parent would make. They also have to cover expenses such as child care, education, medical care. She's in maybe about first, second grade. So there's a lot that's going to come due to good old Chris.
Good times.
Hopefully he's not the father.
Yeah. So, Stephen, let's talk about if you have an uncle who's a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just go to your judge uncle for getting a search warrant executed?
That struck me as really troubling. I'm not in law enforcement, I'm not a criminal practitioner, but that struck me as maybe a little strange that she was going over her captain's head to go to a uncle sort of after dinner at night to get a search warrant. So, of course, everyone knows the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution is the one that protects the rights of the accused in a criminal investigation. Warrants must be based on probable cause to arrest a person or to search their property. And the Supreme Court in the 20th century, although it doesn't say this in the Fourth Amendment, requires a judicial officer to issue warrants, with the idea that the judge or the judiciary is going to protect the rights of the accused against perhaps overzealous search or arrest by the law enforcement agencies. So judicial officers are usually judges, like Judge Judy, Uncle Judge William Judy. And so the issue is whether the Supreme Court has said that the judges have to be neutral and detached as the first requirement. And the second requirement is that they have to be able to independently assess the evidence supporting probable cause to neutrally determine whether there's enough evidence to arrest the person. Query whether Judge Judy is neutral and detached, given that it's his niece who's seeking the warrant. So that seems a little problematic, and if the warrant is unconstitutional, then Chris can suppress all of the evidence that was obtained from his trailer, and it's not usable in his prosecution under the exclusionary rule. It strikes me, though, that this is maybe more of an ethical issue. Lawyers and judges have very strict codes of ethics, especially for judges, with the idea that the public has to trust that judges are going to be fair and not be biased based on who's participating in the litigation. And most states have prohibitions on judges presiding over criminal trials where a family member within 3 degrees of family relationship, and a niece and an uncle is just 2 degrees, so they're within that scope. If the law enforcement officer is going to be a witness or a complaining officer, because it just looks bad, and we don't want to erode the public trust in the judicial process. So it strikes me that that's a little problematic. Maybe we can have some expert input at some point on that with the judges in the audience.
And if the judge refers to the police officer as sweetheart.
Sweetheart, yes.
That's a flag.
And then he looks grave and he's like, come in. Like, they're going to be like a secret cabal. Like, it's very troubling.
Yeah. Our judge here is cringing right now.
We were discussing how would you cure this, and one option could be for Uncle William to listen and go like, yeah, that's a problem. I'm going to call the duty judge. Like, you're going to talk to the duty judge now. Mm-hmm. So that's the judge could refer it to someone who's a judge that's not related.
Yeah.
And that could remedy the situation, because we want people who are guilty of crimes to get arrested and not have the Fourth Amendment violated. So, again, a way around the situation. So let's talk about vigilante holding the vet staff at gunpoint. Kathy, is that kidnapping?
So, in Washington State, it's first-degree kidnapping if you intentionally abduct another person with the intent to, and then there's a list of things that you that it would make it kidnapping. Hold the person for ransom or reward as a hostage or a shield. I don't think vigilante intends to do that here, so we don't meet that one. Facilitate commission of a felony or flight thereafter. That one could be, you know, because they are going to basically kill the cow at this point. To inflict bodily injury on the victim. So, well, at first he intends to kill them. So, yes, that could also be kidnapping. But then he does change his mind later on, remember? And when he's asked about, they're just going to tape them up, he's like, well, we shouldn't use duct tape because that'll hurt them, right? And so he was okay with killing them but not using duct tape to bind them.
So sweet.
Inflict extreme mental distress on the victim. It's vigilante. I think he's a psychopath. So,
but a nice psychopath.
That's true. He's a compassionate one. Or to interfere with the performance of any governmental function. I don't think we have that here. And also importantly, abduct means to restrain a person by either secreting or hiding them in a place where they are unlikely to be found, or using or threatening to use deadly force. Well, they kidnapped them, they kept them in the vet clinic. So are they likely to be found there? I would say yes. So there's a question whether or not there's they qualify as having been abducted. But in second degree, kidnapping applies to all other abductions. So I would say that at a minimum, you probably have second degree kidnapping, maybe not first degree. It kind of depends on some other factors. But also, they probably are guilty. I think they definitely are guilty of unlawful imprisonment, because you just knowingly restrain another person. Doesn't matter where they are or for what purpose. That is unlawful imprisonment.
Yeah, not good there. So let's talk about witness bribing. And Stephen,
yeah,
is offering a trip to Tahoe,
yeah,
in exchange for false testimony to prosecute a neo-Nazi bribery.
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, obviously. Yeah, this is a very simple answer to that question. Yeah, of course, Leota goes to talk to the witnesses and says, so maybe you didn't see who you thought you saw, and even if you did, then how would you like an all-expense-paid trip to Lake Tahoe? And I like that she specified the Nevada side of Lake Tahoe and not the California side, because that's where the casinos are. That's where they'd want to go, of course. So yes, that is. And she and the guy actually is like, are you trying to bribe us? And she's like, no, of course not. And he says, yeah, oh, I was hoping you would bribe me. So there's no question that was they were clearly accepting a bribe. That is not okay. That is a crime, yes. Oh, and it's like an obstruction of justice crime, right? That's preventing the administration of justice. So,
and it
yes,
is a felony. So
it is,
don't
yeah,
do it.
No good.
However, a court will take judicial notice that Incline Village in the Nevada side of Lake Tahoe is the best side.
Perfectly acceptable bride, yeah.
So let's talk about the alienation of affection. And Gabby, help us out with Amber. Infatuation with Peacemaker.
I mean, you know, Amber's just trying to get love. That's all. But it's also, so this is a crazy little thing. You know, we always see in the law and there's all these kind of weird quirks, a lot of which are still in the books. And particularly this alienation of affection, it's a civil suit. It is known as the homewrecker tort. It is still on the books in 6 states, including Hawaii, North Carolina, New Mexico, South Dakota, and Utah. So if you have a spouse that is cheating on you in any of those states, you can do something about it. To succeed in an alienation claim, the plaintiff must show, so this would be Amber's spouse, the marriage entailed love between the spouses in some degree. That might be a little tricky to prove in this case. The spousal love was alienated, and the defendant's malicious conduct contributed to or caused the loss of affection. So clearly, Amber's spouse would be bringing this against Peacemaker, and that he was the cause of this alienation of love that they had between them. And it's actually not necessary to show that the defendant had an intent to destroy the relationship, but only that he or she intentionally engaged in acts which would foreseeably impact the marriage. And so he can definitely, you know, obviously Peacemaker didn't set out to destroy this lovely, loving couple's relationship, but there may be, if alienation of affection was a recognized tort in Washington State, he may have a claim, although the love part may get in there.
And who could really foresee that, like, tying someone up to a chair would cause them to fall in love with you? Like, that seems like kind of a counterpoint. I would defend Peacemaker from this. I feel like it is a good argument.
Yeah, and bonding over a love of music definitely shows something in common. If you want to learn more about the alienation of affection, read my blog post on the Legal Geeks on the question of whether Daddy could sue Santa Claus for kissing Mommy. So let's talk about defamation. Kathy, can you help us through?
All right, we're going to spend some time on this one. One of my favorite things about this show are all of the great reads and insults, and no one is spared, right? Peacemaker insults everybody from his co-workers to children in a classroom to superheroes. So when you're talking about defamation, there are two types. There's libel, which is a defamatory statement that is written. So newspapers, magazines, internet, things like that. Slander is a defamatory statement that is spoken. So the common law elements of defamation are you have an oral or written communication of a false statement about another that's made to a third party that unjustly harms their reputation, and that the person making the statement did so negligently, recklessly, or intentionally. And then we also have, within that, we have slander or libel per se. So remember, we have the on the previous slide, you had to show that the statement, purported defamatory statement, harmed the person's reputation. Certain statements are considered to be so egregious that they are presumed to have harmed the person's reputation. So examples of these kinds of egregious statements are statements that a person was involved in a crime, statement that a person has a loathsome disease, statements that the person was unchaste or engaged in sexual misconduct, or statements that a person engaged in improper conduct of their business, trade, or profession. That's something like, oh, you know, so-and-so cheats his customers, something like that. That would be, and that doesn't mean that it's automatically defamatory, it just means that the harm to the person's reputation is presumed. You wouldn't have to prove that element at trial if you have those kinds of statements. So what are defenses to defamation? These are just some of them that are in most states. Each jurisdiction may have specific ones to their particular state. But some of the most common ones are truth. So you know, truth is an absolute defense. If the statement is true, then it's not defamatory. Opinions. You're entitled to have your own subjective opinions about something, and that is not a defamatory statement. Fair comment on a matter of public interest. So this is where you're going to see like the pundits on the Sunday political shows, things like that. But remember, it's fair comment, right? It's got to be fair comment. It can't be just statements that are totally out there like we do hear about sometimes. It's got to be a fair comment on a matter of public interest. And then one of my favorite ones, vulgar abuse of vituperative statements. These basically, I call this the cursing. The curse word thing. So if you say somebody is an a-hole, you don't literally mean that they are a anatomical part of the body, right? It's a figure of speech. So that's not considered, if you make a statement like somebody's an a-hole, that isn't considered to be defamation. It's also kind of opinion too, right? And then you also have some privileges. There are certain statements that you make in certain situations that are considered privileged, and they wouldn't be considered defamation. And the two most common ones are when you're in litigation, you're involved in litigation with somebody. You file a lawsuit, you make allegations in the complaint. Those are considered to be privileged statements that you are making, and they wouldn't be considered defamatory. The other is when you are reporting crimes to law enforcement, because we don't want to discourage people from being sued civilly if they call the police because they believe a crime is being committed. Now, that's qualified, because it has to be, you have to be fair about it. You can't just like call knowingly, knowing that, you know, I can't say, call the police and say, Steven's committing a crime if I know he's not, just because I want to get him in trouble. That wouldn't be privilege statement. But if it's an honest belief that you believe a crime is being committed or someone has committed a crime, you can report that to law enforcement without being worried about being sued for defamation. So I'm going to focus on, when we talk about the statements that Peacemaker makes, the statements that he makes about superheroes. And when you have, you're dealing with allegations of defamatory statements about public officials or figures, there is a heightened standard that was established by the Supreme Court in the New York Times v. Sullivan case. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that if a person suing for defamation is a public official or a person running for office, they also have to prove that the statement was made with actual malice. So this is the actual malice standard. And that means that the speaker knew that the statement was false, or that the speaker recklessly discarded whether it was true or not. You might have heard about this case recently in the news, because when Sarah Palin went to trial against the New York Times and lost because she could not prove that heightened standard of actual malice about statements that were contained in an article about her by the New York Times. And the Supreme Court, and I know you're, some of you may be thinking, well, Sarah Palin isn't a public official right now, or when she was in trial, but in 1967, the Supreme Court applied that heightened standard to public figures as well. So the heightened standard did apply to Sarah Palin. I would argue that it also applies to superheroes because they are well-known public figures. So let's get into the statements and analyze them. I selected some that were some of my favorites.
Particularly defamatory?
Yes. So we've got comments about Batman. He's a another word for a cat. So that vulgar abuse, that vituperative language that I mentioned before, right? So that he doesn't really mean that he's a cat. He just doesn't like Batman. I would also argue that could be opinion as well. All right, so now we've got, well, he's a jackass who wrestles with murderers, dressed like clowns, and throws them in prison so they can break out of prison and murder more people. That's speaking truth to power.
Yep.
I would argue that is truth. Truth is an absolute defense. So now we've got Wonder Woman. And he says about Wonder Woman, she IF'd him across the room while they were at a party.
And he says it to children.
Yes. So remember we talked about slander per se, that certain statements are presumed to cause, or presumed to actually harm someone's reputation. So allegations of sexual misconduct is one, or that a person is unchaste was one of those presumed egregious statements. But I would argue that this is opinion. This is Peacemaker's interpretation of what he thinks he saw from a glance or whatever that from across the room that Wonder Woman gave him. So it's possible that it is his opinion, and so there would be a defense there. Next, let's go to the Green Arrow statements. So he says, I heard he goes to brony conventions dressed as the back half of Twilight Sparkle. With a 4-inch wide butthole drilled into his costume. And then Hippodamo says, I heard it's true. So who thinks this is defamation? Anyone? We got a couple of hands back there. So do you think, well, remember we talked about this is another allegation of sexual misconduct.
Or being unchaste.
Being unchaste, yes. But he does qualify it. He says, I heard. Mm-hmm. Right, so it is kind of a qualified statement. So that one's a little bit of a closer call there, whether or not the opinion, it would be opinion, it would be privileged or a defense. And then my favorites, we get all the comments about Aquaman, that basically Aquaman has intimate relations with fish. So in episode one, he tells the janitor guy on Twitter, meaning he's referring to Pepe the Frog. 89, works at the aquarium. Says for $50 he brings him in the back so he can have his way with sturgeon. So again, it's a qualified statement. He's talking about something that he read. Now, I don't think Pepe the Frog is a reliable source, let's put it that, and you know, for journalistic standards, that would not hold up. But he is talking about what he read on the internet. So I would argue that there is a possible defense there as well. The Peacemaker says in the last episode, if you've seen the end, that he tells Aquaman to his face, go F another fish. Again, that's just vulgar abuse. It's a statement that is he's made after an incredibly hard-fought battle, and he's carrying his friend off the battlefield to get her medical care. He might even not have the be in the right mind, but and also the Justice League showed up late. And Aquaman says, I'm so effing tired of that rumor. And then the Flash says, it's not a rumor. So that one, we'll have to see. You know, that depends. I think we need a little bit more facts and context to know whether or not the Flash
actually.
Aquaman
too.
So with that rather extensive legal analysis, let's talk about what happens with the fact that we have the White Dragon, Peacemaker's dad, shoot Eagly.
So, I mean, first of all, Augie's in all sorts of trouble. But specifically for harming Eagly, I mean, just the fact that he took down a bird that hugs other people crimes against humanity. But in the legal standard, he would be guilty of violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Acts. Both provide protection because, again, as we mentioned earlier, eagles are no longer endangered, but they are still protected under these two acts. So the Migratory Bird Treaty Act protects migratory bird species without prior authorization, and particularly the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act provides criminal penalties for persons who pursue, shoot at, kill, capture, or otherwise disturb a bald or golden eagle, which Aki definitely did several of those. And so his punishment would be about 1 to 2 years in prison and or fines up to $250,000.
So, pivoting to the cow.
Oh.
Stephen?
Yeah.
Was it genocide or kill the cow?
Yeah, I mean, so this is governed by international law. This isn't something that's, although this was, this Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide was passed in the sort of mid-century, 1948, I think, by the international community, and then it was ratified by the U.S. not until 1988. So, but we are a signatory to this convention. And of course, if you're entirely destroying the species source, one and only source of food, seems like that would be a pretty clear case of genocide. But just to tie this to current events, you might know that the genocide of Russian-speaking Ukrainians was the reason why Ukraine was invaded, and then the Ukraine sued Russia under this convention in March, and the International Court of Justice actually just issued a interim order against Russia to stop the invasion. Because of this convention. So interesting connection with real world events right now.
So let's talk about the Peacemaker killing his dad. Gabby, what are the possible defenses?
Well, sadly, Josh, there is no law on the books that allows a defense for killing basically a super villain grand wizard of the KKK. That is not a thing yet. It probably should be, but it is not. Peacemaker has several options. He has defense of self. Washington state law allows a person to use reasonable force to defend themselves when they're being attacked or have a reasonable belief that they're being attacked. At this point, when Peacemaker goes to shoot Augie, he's kind of been disarmed. So is he really imminent? I mean, he does have other weapons. He could just start wailing on him. So You could imagine he is a threat, and that there is a self-defense claim that could be made. Defense of others, right? Vigilante is there, Economos is there, he has others that he's trying to protect.
Eagly
is down, right? So he's trying to protect others. There's a citizen's arrest argument that could be made, but unfortunately citizen's arrest is, in Washington State, only apply to misdemeanors, so that's he's not getting anywhere with that. And then he really does have a provocation defense. That actions are, that are partly the result of a preceding set of events that might cause a reasonable individual to lose self-control. And Augie's goading him, right? He's goading him into shooting him. And that's on top of all the child abuse and lifetime of abuse that he suffered at Augie's hands. So really there's a reasonable person, I think, would maybe feel compelled to do that.
So, Judo Master gets captured after getting hit with a car, clubbed, shot. Is there a duty to render aid to Judo Master Kathy?
So, in common law, there's no general duty to come to the rescue of another. But there are some exceptions where you are required to actually come to the aid. If there is a special relationship, a parent-child, common carriers, which is like airlines and trains and buses, employer-employee, and spouses have a duty to help rescue if that other person in the relationship is in peril. Also, there is a duty to rescue if you created the hazardous condition or situation. So I would argue here that our peacemaker gang created this condition, right? They're lying in wait, trying to kill a senator and his family. And they beat up Judo Master, they hit him with the truck, and for good measure, then they beat him with a tire iron. So they definitely created the situation that caused Judo Master to suffer injury, so they probably do have a duty to come to his aid. And we know that they do, right? They do bring him in and they do provide medical care. So another issue is we have Good Samaritan laws in most states, and that means that there's no civil liability to people who provide reasonable assistance to injured persons. So for example, you're driving down the road and you come across a car accident, you get out and you try to help. The thought and the purpose behind these kinds of laws is that we want to encourage people to help out their fellow civilians and citizens and help provide aid. And if people were afraid of getting sued or going to jail because they did that and maybe they didn't provide the right kind of care or whatever, or the person died anyways, they wouldn't stop and help, right? So we want to encourage people to stop and help, you know, other people. So most states have put into place these Good Samaritan laws, which basically say that if you do, even though if you don't have a duty to call for aid or come to their rescue or to provide aid, if you do, you are protected from being sued as long as, you know, you are, and in Washington State specifically, you have to be doing it without the expectation of receiving compensation. But it does also cover first responders as well. So you're protected if you provide aid, if you transport them to seek medical care, but you're not protected if, while you're providing this aid, you're grossly negligent or you're willful or you have willful or wanton misconduct, meaning you're intending to actually hurt the person under the guise of providing aid. So here I would say it's kind of questionable whether there's some gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct. I mean, Judo Master is he's at least in a coma. And what we see is they basically put him on a couch and hook him up to an IV. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are any CT scans. Yeah, there are no CT scans done. I don't think they do any x-rays to see if he's got broken bones, internal bleeding, anything. So I would argue that might be gross negligence there. They know this guy has had some pretty serious injuries and they just give him an IV and they don't bother to take him to the hospital.
So, don't do that. Now, we have a few minutes for questions, which was the goal here. So, here's your information to follow those of us who are on social media.
I am not.
And information on how you can follow the Legal Geeks and our podcast. And we'll be back here tomorrow to discuss the law of Star Trek at 2 o'clock. All of that said, any questions? Yes, sir.
Would the Second Amendment allow me to possess a Russian tank shell and every day
So the question is, does the Second Amendment, which allow vigilante to have a Russian tank shell and a grenade, and I don't know if that starts with vigilante and goes to peacemaker, peacemaker just happened to have that artillery. And it's important to remember with the Second Amendment, it allows for reasonable regulation. And anti-tank weapons, historically, are not allowed to be owned by civilians. Same with grenades. Same with landmines. So there's a, we draw lines with that. I mean, it's why we discussed, is there an actual need for someone to have an AR-15? Do you need a weapon of war for self-defense? You know, do you need a weapon that can kill 10 people in 9 seconds?
And it would also depend on the state. So different states, obviously there is the Second Amendment, but different states have different laws about what you can and cannot have. So like Connecticut has one of the strictest gun laws or a series of gun laws in the country, so that would also factor into it. So it's a state law thing and a federal thing.
Great question.
Good question, because people wonder, what about the Second Amendment? Yes, sir.
In one of the program descriptions, it mentions that supposedly you can't take an oath to kill anybody for any peace.
Yes. Summarize for the recording that the thoughtful distinction you have made with taking an oath that I believe in peace and I'm willing to kill every man, woman, and child in order to do so, and acting on it. And that is a good distinction. Now, say I've taken an oath to kill people because of my view of peace, probably isn't enough for probable cause to go get a search warrant to see if you are amassing tank shells and grenades. Because we call that concerning behavior. So, red flag. And that can also trigger red flag laws, which California is one of those states where you could go get a warrant to go, you've made some really scary statements online. You don't get to own guns anymore. And I was on a hearing for another case, and they were finishing up a hearing where somebody's guns had been taken after that individual displayed disturbing behavior and comments. And then he wanted his guns back, and the court's like, So,
I just have to brag real quick. Connecticut was the first state to pass the red flag law, so just updated it. So, some humble brag right there.
And I'll also do a humble brag that the San Diego City Attorney's Office has been a leader in the state of California in pursuing gun violence restraining orders. And we actually go around to the state and educate other law enforcement agencies on how to pursue and obtain gun violence restraining orders from courts in order to keep guns out of the hands of individuals who have made serious threats or are involved in domestic violence.
And with that, we're out of time. Thank you for your attending, and have a wonderful rest of the day.
That's good.